All right, I think we're going to get started here. It is 5:30, and you guys are a brave crowd here for showing up. We've got kind of an intimate setting up here and a little bit more of a kind of dispersed. Please come on up if you want to. My name's Greg Stauffer. I'm from the University of Colorado, Boulder. I am doing the online moderation for this. We are streaming this presentation. So although this is a different kind of format, we are going to have time at the end for questions, so it'll be traditional in that regard. And if you do have questions, please use one of the microphones. And if you'd like me to bring a microphone to you, let me know. Raise your hand. Hopefully you all are accustomed to filling out the online evaluations. There's a link to that from the session description, and we'd love your feedback. So I'm going to turn it over to Nancy Millichap. She's from EDUCAUSE, and she is going to moderate and introduce our speaker.
Thank you very much.
You okay?
This is indeed a very large room, I have to say. A bit larger than I was expecting, but I hope everyone here will feel free to regard this, despite the size of the room, as an informal and open discussion, particularly after you've had a chance to hear from the leaders of four breakthrough models that NGLC is very happy to be able to have you hear about today. We've just spent a terrific day working with all 10 of our breakthrough model groups that were the most recent six of which were recently announced, if you've been following the Next Generation Learning Challenges at all. And I'm really pleased that we were able to have representatives of our first four models here today to share their work with you. They are to my left, and they will be appearing in this order, Frederick Hurst from Northern Arizona University, Emily Chu from New Charter University, Yvonne Simon from Southern New Hampshire University, and Van Davis from the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. I'd like to say just a couple of things about the Next Generation Learning Challenges, which many of you, if you've attended EDUCAUSE conferences in the last year or two, have probably heard about some of our earlier work, especially the building blocks for college completion, where 29 different higher education institutions were involved in putting quality technology-enhanced tools in place to improve the college completion chances, especially for disadvantaged and minority young adults. NGLC as a whole is seeking out, investing in, and looking to advance knowledge and networks of institutions and other organizations that are going to increase the completion rates for college and the readiness for college among that target population that I mentioned. So we're hoping to provide investment capital initially to collect and share evidence, and then to foster that community of innovators and adopters across the institutions that really have the great ideas about how we can dramatically change things in higher education as far as the success rates go for all learners, but especially underrepresented ones. And the people that you see here on the stage are among those that are developing those solutions, that have some really great models in mind, and that are going to be carrying them out, telling you about a bit about them today. The Next Generation Learning Challenges is an initiative that began in 2010. EDUCAUSE is the leading partner, and we have three other association partners in our work. The League for Innovation and the Community College is our partner in the higher education sphere. And on the K-12 side, since NGLC does span both higher education and K-12 education, we have partners in the Council of Chief State School Officers and INACOL, the International Association for K-12 Online Learning. Our funding partners are the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. And in this current wave about which you're going to be hearing today, We really were looking to, as I mentioned before, dramatically improve the outcomes for students. There were a lot of stipulations in the request for proposals that resulted in these 10 awards about what these breakthrough models needed to do. They were to be at least 25% to 100% online. They were to be customized, personalized, affordable, both for the student and for the institution to offer. They were to use analytics. They were to use other forms of technology to enable students to have customized pathways for learning. And they were, of course, to be of high quality and to produce better than, dramatically better outcomes for students. And you're going to hear from our presenters today about four ways in which that happens. The leaders of the Wave 3 projects are rethinking the student support model. They're using technology to make more personalized and customized pathways. They're making the programs more affordable in a variety of ways, including new approaches to human resources and staffing, new approaches to delivery, and credit for what students have already learned either in the workplace or in prior educational experiences. They're letting students make their own way through the materials. They're providing ways for students to learn if one modality doesn't work. If the text doesn't work for you, what about video? And they're finding new ways to assess the learning and use that assessment to improve the outcomes for the students and also the way that the institution delivers the educational experience. With that, I will hand the podium over to Frederick Hurst from Northern Arizona University.
Thanks, Nancy. I'm going to start with a quote. You know, this is the end of the day, and I like quotes. In this particular case, I chose this quote because I think this sort of describes how it is when you're trying to do something new. And this is a quote from Samuel Butler, who in 1895 said, "Life is like playing a violin solo in public and learning the instrument as one goes on." You know, that's really the way we often feel when we're trying to move some of our projects forward. I'm going to talk just very shortly about innovation and regulation. And, you know, each of our programs, in a general sense, every institution is required to meet get the approval of their accrediting organization in order to offer any program, and especially an innovative program that is new and unusual requires that sort of approval. It also is necessary for us to receive approval from the U.S. Department of Education for to receive Title IV federal financial aid for our programs. And so I'm just going to talk a little bit about that process. First, on the regional accreditation approval, every institution in the country is approved by one of six regional accreditation bodies. And the list is up there on the screen for you. The process of being approved for a competency-based learning program, which is what the group up here, what we're all trying to do, is based on a law that was passed by Congress in 2005 that allows institutions who have been approved by their regional accreditation body to offer federal financial aid to students. And of course, that's very critical, especially for students who don't have a different source of support to pay tuition and other fees. The competency-based approval, there's only been one institution in the history of the country who's been approved, and that's Southern New Hampshire University, and you'll be hearing from Southern New Hampshire just here in a minute. And they were approved just this last September. So these are very new programs that we're working on. The second part of this is, as I said, the U.S. Department of Education approval for students who offer competency-based, what they call it is direct assessment programs. What this really means is a direct assessment program, rather than a student sitting through a three-hour course, they may be able to take a test and test out of the of that requirement for that course. It's a very different sort of approach, and so as I said, the law was changed in 2005. Again, Southern New Hampshire University applied in early October. At this point, I think that they believe that it will take anywhere from several months to maybe half a year to go forward with that. And so I'm going to turn it over to Emily Chu and here in just a second. But first, I have another quote for you. And that quote is an American proverb. It doesn't work to leap a 20-foot chasm in two 10-foot jumps. And so what we're all trying to do is leap that 20-foot chasm in just one, mm-hmm. one jump.
Thanks.
Emily?
Thanks. Hi, I'm Emily Chu. I'm the Senior Director of Strategy and Partnerships at University Now, which launched New Charter University this year. We're really excited to be part of this wave of NGLC grantees. In part, the grant that we received was to fund research to explore our partnership in conjunction with a traditional community college. And I'm really excited to share with you today how we're thinking about innovating upon business models and just kind of rethinking how we design the model for higher education. So just to get started, for University Now, our mission is to ensure that higher education is available to people everywhere. And for us, in terms of the way that we see the world, there are a couple of challenges that we see. We see global demand that's surging due to the emerging class of people who need to be trained for the knowledge economy, and a system that largely cannot serve or meet the demand. We see U.S. growth driven by key segments, such as underrepresented minorities and working adults, and in large part, this is the demographic that we're trying to serve. We also see federal regulations that have tied the industry to costly time-based models, and a lot of innovation to us is moving away from seat time and thinking about new approaches, competency-based approaches, self-paced approaches, in order to provide more flexibility for learners, in order to personalize education for learners, and to really reduce the costs and create more access. So what is the University Now and New Charter University model? First of all, we'll start with a couple of assumptions. For us right now, we still think that accreditation matters. And so what we are building is an accredited model that's also freemium. We believe that affordability matters. We also believe that people need individualized coach-driven support and that the model should be self-paced, which for us is a little bit synonymous with it being competency-based. In terms of how our model and our business model compares to the traditional model, we see the world this way. For us, we believe it's really important to allow students to access school first and pay later. For us, this means really reducing the barriers to being able to access education and for students to really be able to see what they're paying for before they decide to take on tens of thousands of dollars of debt and commit to something that they don't really know the value of yet. For us, it's also really important for students to be able to pay out of pocket and really to move away from the significant amount of debt that students are taking on. And this is reflected in the model that we've built. For New Charter University, we have a flat pricing at $199 a month, which kind of breaks down to be the cost of cable. And a lot of what this is making it such that people pay a flat rate. There's, you know, tuition, books, fees are all included in that, and people can take as many courses as they can get through and do so without taking on debt. Another really huge distinction for us is, again, moving away from seat time. For us, time is what varies, and people can take as much or as little time as they need in order to demonstrate mastery of a course, and it's the standards that are constant. Really designing for an outcomes-based model that prepares people for the workforce and prepares people for the skills that they need for 21st century jobs. And finally, you know, there's a lot of different models being explored. Some are very peer-to-peer driven, which we do have a component of. But we do believe that intensive student support and individualized coaching is still important. And so we have a coach-driven model and instructor-driven model that is supported by a technology system which demonstrates to them exactly where a student stands at any given moment. So the coaching and support that they can provide to the student can be very individualized to that student's needs. So for us, as a new model, a lot of the challenge is how can we bring down tuition without sacrificing quality, especially in an environment in which it's really, the burden is kind of on new models to prove that they are quality. For us, you know, a big component of bringing down costs is to operate our schools online, but that in and of itself isn't so new. Online schools have been available for a really long time. For us, moving away from Title IV, we are eligible but non-participatory, is important because that's a big component for us in reducing our overhead costs and being able to move towards a competency-based model. Our schools operate on an open learning platform, and we're really excited about that, in that students can log in and get started by logging in through their Facebook and Twitter account. It's exciting for us to have the freemium model in that you could be enrolled as a student, but you can invite your friend, your neighbor, your mother to learn alongside you simply by just logging in with social media. Speaking of business model, a big part of why we can pass along cost savings to students is really to rethink how we're marketing. For traditional universities, often a third and upwards of their revenues are tied to the cost of recruiting and marketing to students. And for us, we really believe that we need to be innovative and creative in how we do so by building community, by leveraging social networks, and by really using open content and new ways of thinking through things, largely driven by consumer models and technology models, as ways to reach students without the burden of traditional marketing costs. So for us, that translates into some of the lowest tuition in the country. This chart just shows where New Charter stands as well as where our hybrid model stands. And short of California community colleges, we believe that we're one of the most affordable regionally accredited models in the country. This is just a bit of a screenshot of our technology model. And this is really important for us. We built a technology platform from scratch. Because we believe that this is really what's needed in order to drive and power a competency-based model, as well as provide real-time data and analytics to personalize education to students and provide a two-way mirror so at any given time, not only does the student know exactly where they stand and where they need to focus and what they need to do in order to unlock the next step, but faculty and coaches can also see exactly where students stand. So when they reach out to the students, it's not to see where they stand and what they're struggling with. It's to say, hey, I know that you read two chapters of that section before abandoning. I know exactly what you've struggled with, what you've mastered, and I can deliver my instruction to very much target what you need help on. So that's just a screenshot, and we think this is another really important part of being able to support our model, which is self-paced, competency-based, data-driven, and with a disaggregated faculty model. So with that, I'll stop there and turn it over to Yvonne from Southern New Hampshire University. Thank you. Forgot about that.
Thank you, Emily. Good evening. As Emily said, I'm Yvonne Simon from Southern New Hampshire University, and I'm speaking today about the College for America program at Southern New Hampshire University. I'm the Chief Learning Officer, and I am part of the innovation team. So I'm very happy to be here as part of the NJLC community and also to share this model with you. I'm going to be highlighting an aspect of our program that we think is fairly unique. It's about student participatory design. And I just want to say to everybody, maybe you're not fortunate enough to be in an environment where you have, an innovation lab, but just think about from the student's perspective what you might be able to do to move your program in this direction, and I'll speak a little bit later about why that's important. So just to give you a framework of our program, we're innovating on many levels, like my colleagues, and I just want to highlight a few things so that you understand our framework. We have no courses, so we've unbundled down to the competency level. In our associate's degree in general studies, which is our first offering, we have 120 competencies that students have to master. And they do that through completing tasks. There are about 74 tasks, depending on the path that students take. And that's a very personalized path. Students can start very easily with a level one task, or a two, or a three. And what we're trying to do here is really meet the students where they are. We believe very strongly in early wins. So a student takes a task, they hopefully get feedback from their evaluator in about 48 hours, less if possible, and then they're on to the next task. They can submit as often as they need to achieve mastery, and we really believe in encouraging sustained effort. So if you submit an assignment and you don't achieve mastery in the first, you won't get a stop or an X or a red mark. You'll simply get a yellow to encourage you along those lines. So as I was mentioning, we don't have an instructor role either. We've unbundled that instructor role as well. So students have a coach, they have an accountability partner, and they also have a mentor, and then evaluators, a third-party group of separate evaluators work and give feedback to the students. So that's the general framework. Oh, the one other thing I should mention, at this point, we do not have a retail model, if you will. We work through our employee partners. They include municipalities and community organizations to recruit our students. So what I really want to get to, and if you remember one thing from this presentation, it's that students are at the heart of developing this program. We've been working with the Business Innovation Factory to develop this student participatory model. And what that means is that students are actually involved in designing the program. We've done two tests so far. One was in August, was very small, only 7 tasks. So if you think about, eventually we'll have 74, and in the summer we have only had seven. But we really wanted to test that basic concept of the learning model and see what students thought about it. And one of the best things about that summer experience is that students got it very easily. Sometimes this is so hard to explain, but when we actually engaged students in the program, they were very responsive. They got it right away. The second test was really about asking the question, does our interface, our online interface, it's virtual for most of it, does that interface make sense to our students? Can they make meaning out of things such as competencies and tasks? These aren't courses, the things that they're used to. Can they make sense out of that? And then we're gearing up for our big pilot in January. So that's coming up. So let me just share just a little bit of the learnings with you. What you see here is from a final report we just got days ago, actually. So we're still digesting the findings. But I think it's very interesting to think about how our students often tell us things that we don't think about. We create these models and they think they're great, and then when we actually put them out to students, they have some very insightful thinking about this. And I think in engaging students in this model, this low-cost, high-access model, it's actually critical to involve them in this right from the beginning so that they feel validated as learners and contributors. In some ways, some of these students have been kept on the outside of higher ed, and this is a great way to just bring them right into the conversation. So this is the knowledge map, and I'm very thankful that this exists on paper only right now, because we learned so much when we took this out to students. And what they said to us is, well, that's nice, all these competencies, but that's kind of confusing. So in the end, we have this. So if this were interactive, I'd click right here, and you'd be able to see that competency map disappear. And some of them, however, said, but I would use it for planning. You know, I like to be able to see the relationship between task families and competencies when I'm planning. But basically, for the most part, I don't need to see that. So that helped us move forward on that design feature. What they loved was the progress bar. One student said, that would be revolutionary. And that, to me, was just such a surprise that something as simple as a progress bar would be revolutionary. They said, in other learning experiences, they never really knew where they were and what they had done. And this clearly shows what the students can do by the tasks that they've completed. So here's another example of one of our screens in prototype, of course. It's the dashboard. And here was really, this is one of the most interesting findings around what students wanted to customize and what they didn't want to customize. And we found this was very personal. So some of our students wanted long queues of things that were next up. Some students said, I don't really want to know that. Just surprise me. Like, you know, serve it up as we go. Students all did, however, want to know what students were online and what tasks they were working on. Sounds obvious, but But these are the kind of things that we were really confirmed as we worked with our students. This last page, I'll just share a bit about this, is the task page. And here, we also learned about what students were willing to share. We hope to move into a peer-to-peer model where peers are supporting each other. And what we saw was a real range of interest in that and ability and confidence that they could do that. So that's something we'll have to really work towards as we move this model forward. And I'm going to end with a quote. Our students at the end of the first summer pilot were very forward with their comments and thoughts, and this one really moved me, and I just want to share it with all of you, because if you're considering anything like this, the demand for transformation is just astounding. And when I heard some of the comments, it really motivated me even more than I already am to keep going. So I'll just read this one. As I asked this question, the student said, well, I asked, what's different about this? And she said, well, I'm not a fan of school, and I hate deadlines, and it really stresses me out. But then, once I realized you could go back, I felt okay, relaxed. I realized I actually enjoy writing. I was so excited about my paragraph that I called my friend and read it to her. She said, who knew you could write, right? And just this last one, the students feel very engaged in this whole process, and I think that's the key to student-centered design. It's really about a process, an evolving process that's going to continue to change over time. And this student just said, this is all about changing history, not only higher ed, but history. And that's what I'm, the student in this case, is really excited about. So thank you very much. And Van, I'll turn it over to you now.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Van Davis, and I'm the Director of Special Projects at the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board, which is our state agency that tries to coordinate, not regulate, higher education in Texas. I want to talk to you a little bit about the Texas Affordable Baccalaureate Project. In January, February of 2011, our Governor Rick Perry issued a challenge to all of our public higher education institutions in his State of the State address. And it came as a surprise to all of us. His challenge, and you probably read about this in the Chronicle of Higher Ed and Inside Higher Ed, was that we should be able to offer a low-cost, affordable baccalaureate degree at a price point of $10,000, including learning materials, and that every institution should be able to try to do that for at least one of their programs. And there was a great deal of skepticism, both around the state and around the country. But it got a lot of us thinking about the issues of affordability in a different way. And we began to find that clustered at institutions, there were folks who might have felt a little bit like an outsider at their institution, but they were part of an emerging community that was willing to take on that challenge. And we at the Coordinating Board have the honor to work with two of our institutional partners, Texas A&M University Commerce and South Texas College, to develop this program. What we're focusing on is a competency-based, low-cost degree. In this case, it's a Bachelor of Applied Sciences in Organizational Leadership that will give our Texas students, whether they be traditional age, but probably most likely non-traditional returning adult students, to acquire the sort of high-quality education that they need that focuses on 21st century skills so that they can advance in their own careers. And that's a very compelling vision, I think, for a lot of us. And it's the sort of vision that has brought together two very different institutions. I love always throwing this map up because there's almost 600 miles that separates our two partners. Texas A&M University Commerce is up in the northeast rural portion of the state, really. And South Texas College is in McAllen, right at the very tip. In fact, literally just over the border from Mexico. They are two very different schools. Commerce is a four-year public university. South Texas College is one of our three baccalaureate-granting public community colleges. And they have both different faculty groups and different student communities, but they're also located in very different communities and very different cultures. To give you an idea, though, of the sort of impact that these institutions are having and can have in their communities through this program, South Texas College serves Star and Hidalgo counties. In the most recent 2010 decennial census, those counties were, by per capita income, considered to be two of the poorest counties in the United States. Although since South Texas College's start, they have significantly seen a reduction in unemployment, there are still huge needs in those counties. And this is really where the affordability issue comes into play for us. We know that as a state, we're not going to be able to advance unless we see more of our citizens who have a baccalaureate degree. We know that their families, their children, and their grandchildren are going to experience very different lives if their parents and their grandparents have a bachelor's degree. And we know that our state and our nation will experience a very different quality of living, not just economic standard of living, but a different quality. Mm-hmm. And that for us is what this program and this vision is about, finding ways to provide affordable education to change lives. One of the challenges that we have to face is that we're not putting out what people think we should be. In academia, if we had a student, I was a professor for a little over a decade, when I had a student that scored a 25 on an exam, I gave him an F. This is a quote from one of the studies that AACU did as part of their LEAP initiative. 25% of our employers, only 25%, think that we're doing a good job. And we see study after study after study, whether it's employer studies, whether it's the work that the Pew Research Center has done on public opinion, that are saying very similar things. So we're taking a competency approach. You've heard about that from my colleagues here. Well, my slide just went away. Oh, well, it's contagious.
Yes, yeah, it is.
We're taking a competency approach. But what we think really distinguishes us is the way that we're doing it. We're using a variation of the process that Lumina has been developing called the Tuning America Initiative. Is that what it is? Thank you, Fred. Tuning is a collaborative process. If you know anything about the Bologna Accords, it's very similar to that. It's a collaborative process that uses faculty at the center, but also members of the K-12 community and the business community to identify what a student should know when they graduate, but not just what they should know, what they should be able to do with that. What is the application? What do the skills look like? What should they be able to do with that knowledge? The idea of behind tuning is that not only is it a collaborative process, but it's also a process in which you see transparency. Everyone knows what the student should come out with, including the student. And everyone understands the importance of that. We're focusing competencies. We're focusing on knowledge, skills, attitudes, and abilities. And the process is what I want to end here with so that you have an idea of how we're doing it, because this is a collaborative process. And that's wonderful. It will be the strength of the program. But if you've ever done collaboration, you also know that it's very, very messy. And there's a lot of in the weeds sometimes. We use faculty to define the discipline, and we're using two faculty teams and with faculty from both institutions. One is looking at the upper division program and competencies. The other one is looking at the general education competencies. They define the discipline. And then from there, we use a larger group of faculty, business representatives, K-12 representatives, to define the outcomes for students who have the credential. And then from there, that same group, again, now bringing in input, usually through surveys, instruments of current students and graduates, looking at what the desired level achievement is for each of those outcomes at some time, either after graduation or during their program, and then defining the target level for that achievement. And then finally, aligning, and in this case, we're not really working with courses, but we're working with competencies. Aligning all of those competencies so that a student understands how when they work on this, it really connects over here, and they can begin to see not just the growth of their degree and the progress, but they can begin to understand how it works, why it matters, so that it's not just, I'm going to get a credential so that I can get a job, but it's, I know now what I can do when I walk in to that boardroom or that office on the first day, and my boss tells me to do this, and I don't have to go into a panic because I've done it before, and I get how it's done. So we believe that this is a really exciting concept. We believe it's an exciting program that's going to change lives. It's messy, but for us, having faculty squarely at the center, it's important to have the students involved as well. But having the faculty and the students and the business community so involved in this, we believe is going to make a much stronger program. It may be messier to get there, but it's mm-hmm. going to be a really nice product. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And I'd be happy to recognize anyone who'd like to ask questions of Fred, Emily, Yvonne, Van about anything that they said or about their models. We really focused here today on some of the specific and unique examples of their models. But if you have a general question about what they're doing or a general question about any of the unique features they've addressed, please. Yes,
I'm Roy Bowery from the University of Memphis. And Yvonne, you mentioned about self-paced study. So my mind may be fuzzy in the details, but it seems like over the years, indications were that a lot of the old correspondence courses and CD courses, computer-based learning, that if it was at your own pace, there's significant drop-off of students in that. So how's that working out?
Yeah, great question. Can you hear me? No? How about now? Oh, wow. So the way we handle that is to say that it's self-paced, but it's not no pace. And so on the first coaching call, a student will actually set a pace for his or her work. And then what this coach will do is work with the student to keep that pace throughout the program. And that actually worked pretty well on the pilot. That was one of the things we were testing, and we had great success with that, actually. It's not that students always kept the pace, but because they set the pace and you called them on that, they're like, okay, so they had to maybe readjust, but they were always able to kind of continue to move forward rather than drop off.
Did that address the question? Other questions?
Hi, I have a question about the competencies mapping. So in Josh Jarrow's presentation yesterday, one of the things that he pointed out is that, and you guys pointed out too, that it's a lot of work to define what these competencies are, what learning objects are used, how they're assessed, how the correct level of achievement is defined. And so my question is a question to all of you about whether you've thought of ways of packaging what you're doing with these so that it can be reused by other initiatives.
Who'd like to speak to that?
I'll start.
Van?
Our process, I think, is especially a little complicated and messy because we're using so many constituents groups, and we're bringing our faculty together face-to-face once a month, and then they're working in the interim. We made the commitment when we accepted the grant that anything that we created that was not proprietary is going to be made openly available for any institution anywhere. One of the ways that we'll probably go about doing that is that we're in the process of completing the development of the Texas Learning Objects Repository. So I suspect that we will house those materials there as well as make them available to EDUCAUSE and any other ways that they want to do that. But it's one of the themes that I think we've all talked about, especially today, is it doesn't make any sense for us to labor alone. Mm-hmm. That if there are ways that we can help each other, and if there are, certainly I think from our perspective, if there are mistakes that we can make that will prevent you from making them, and if there's materials we can develop that will help you refine them, then that is a win-win for everyone, especially if we can then use what you did.
Fred? Yvonne? Emily? Did you want to speak to that?
I think Van covered it nicely. It did come up quite a bit today as we were discussing things, and I think Van addressed it well, unless people would like to hear more.
Yeah, so I just have a follow-up question. I mean, I think so that if you if you put the learning objects in an OER, LOR, right, and that they're tagged in ways that they can be reused, and I suppose you could have them aligned to the outcomes in the way the metadata is handled in the learning object repository too. That seems useful, and I'm also, so kind of follow-up question is, some of these things actually need to be sets of things, so do you think Common Cartridge is good for that, or do you have other, I mean, I'm looking for things that are concrete and reusable, right?
I'll just say, we're not there yet. I think in thinking about the structure, we've very much modularized things, but our structure, I didn't go into that part of our model, but we have these task families that work together in a very particular way. So I'm not sure if that would be something we could actually give out to the larger community. But I think we are thinking, like Anne was saying, about things that do make sense to me. Emily and I were discussing the competency set itself might be something. But right now, our model doesn't support, I don't think, what you're talking about specifically. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'd add a little bit, and that is, you know, for our model, what we're doing is we're taking our regular courses that have been used over the years at the institution, and we're deconstructing those courses down to learning objectives and competencies, and then redeveloping them, putting them into interdisciplinary courses. While there may be some possibility of using some of those pieces as OER pieces, certainly in the whole, it would be very difficult for any other institution to use them because we don't have a history course. We have a course in small business administration that has history components in it. We have multiple courses that have history components in it. So, you know, it is really sort of a different sort of approach. I think on a very granular level, it may be possible to do what you're talking about.
I think it's probably, I might point out that there are other models that aren't represented here, and one of them that particularly I know is planning to work with Open Educational Resources is a project of the University System of Georgia working with Columbus State. I think they have a fairly prominent place for Open Educational Resources in what they're thinking about. So you might want to, if you're specifically interested in that, you might want to turn to their profile on the NGLC website and contact them about that. I think that would be another one to look at in that regard.
Questions from sort of a couple directions. I've heard the term probably multiple times over the last couple of days about deconstructing the curriculum. Does that mean opening it up and adding more back into it? Or does it actually mean getting rid of a lot of the extraneous material that's crept into the curriculum over the years?
Great question.
That's a great question. I'll start. I think the question that you're asking is really very, very important. You know, we in higher education have always talked about the coherency of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And truthfully, you know, we have at a very high level some coherency, but overall, we don't have coherency in our curriculum. I mean, you know, when you can take any of 25 courses to fulfill a requirement, it's great for exploration, but in terms of giving really concrete skills to a student who wants specific skills to get a job, it's not really that coherent. What we've done, I think, in all of these programs, mm-hmm. pretty much, is put programs that are that are very much based on what the employers are telling us that students need to be successful. So instead of letting, you know, and most of these programs are designed for adult students. So we've really aimed it very much at fulfilling the skill needs that they need to be successful in the workplace.
Yeah, I'll add to that. I mean, for us at New Charter, it's a lot about offering students choice. and offering students a choice of materials that work well for their learning style. And so we do have a range of resources that we offer, from open educational resources to paid textbooks to, you know, students can curate in their own material. You know, if there's a YouTube video or if there's a learning game that help them teach them that concept, help them solve that equation, it's equally valid and they should be able to contribute that to the course. And, you know, students really should have the choice to pick from both what works for them and what they can afford. It's just our philosophy. So it's not so much like stripping things down or building things up. It's a lot of mapping competencies to the resources that help support development of mastery of those competencies and letting students pick what works best for their learning style.
I'd like to, I think the way that I prefer to think of it rather than deconstructing the curriculum is reimagining it. And it's hard, I think, sometimes for faculty at first because we are so acculturated to think in terms of courses. And we also tend to be so very discipline specific that it's hard to think outside of our narrow discipline confines. I'm reminded of a conversation that we had last month when our Gen Ed faculty group got together. And I'll pick on my own profession. I was trained as a historian, and I was eavesdropping on the historians. And, you know, there was a conversation about, well, what, do they need to know about the War of 1812? Do they need to know about, you know, well, what about, you know, the Battle of Gettysburg? There's, I think, sometimes in the introductory level courses, especially when we think that we're only going to get one shot, and we want to try to get everything in, that we have tended to really focus sometimes on pieces of information. At one time, that might have made more sense when we didn't have iPhones and iPads and the internet and instant access to information. Whenever I took my competency exams as a doctoral student, even then it didn't seem to make much sense that I had to do a brain dump when I knew that when I was prepping a lecture, I was just going to go to the library. That was pre-internet days. But what I saw happen with those faculty is over the course of the day, they began to move away from what pieces of information, what facts, to what is it about being a historian that we want students to understand? What is it about the way that historians approach problems or communication that we want students to be able to take away to inform how they approach the world? So for me, it's not about so much deconstructing the curriculum. It's about giving faculty the opportunity to reimagine the curriculum.
Great. Thanks, Ben. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm tending to ignore you because the lights
okay.
are worse in that direction.
I didn't see anyone else over there. So if I understood correctly, Southern New Hampshire University was recently accredited for a competency-based approach, which that is a really, really big deal. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the challenges that you faced with that and how you were successfully able to overcome those.
Do you have a specific area of challenge that you'd like me to focus on? That was probably a lot.
I think just anything that you can offer would help. I mean, I know that there are a lot of people who are exploring this area right now, and accreditation is one of the biggest challenges. So any kind
absolutely.
Of thought yeah. you can offer about how you were able to successfully get there would be helpful.
Right. That wasn't my focus or isn't my focus area. I do have some of my colleagues here that would probably be very happy to help you with that, so I'll offer that up as a further solution. But I'll just say succinctly that I think one of the reasons why, going back to the earlier question about deconstruction, I think in planning this submission, we really wanted to make sure that there was support for the curriculum that we had developed. We were talking about this today earlier as well. So that's why we mapped to Lumina as well, mm-hmm. To that degree qualifications profile. That's why we look at at Southern New Hampshire, we look at our Gen Ed course, and we very carefully line those all up as well as with the employer skills. And so I think, you know, in thinking about this, you know, you have to build credibility for something that doesn't exist. And I think that the long vision of that is that the more people do things like this, the more we'll have a broad swath, someone used today, mm-hmm. and this will become a standard of learning whereas it's not right now. So hopefully this this accreditation helps others move forward. And my colleagues are over that side of the room. I can point them out to you afterwards if you want to talk more.
Thank
you're
you.
Welcome.
Thanks for your question. We are out of time.
Do you want to add something?
But I think that the presenters will be happy to speak with you if you had another individual question you'd like to come up and ask them. Thanks so much for coming this late on the Thursday afternoon, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Oh, I was about to just...